All right. This is awesome. I cannot even tell you. How many people have ever seen me before, even if it was online? The number is astounding only because I do a lot of training on Microsoft Virtual Academy. Usually that's where people stumble onto me. To have this many XAML developers in one room, I mean, do not drop a bomb right now. This is all of us, right? I mean, this feels really nice. So we'll all work together today, and we got to stick together. And so there's a lot of goodness about XAML. There's a lot of good in the future of XAML. I'll just start by saying this to make you all feel good because it's the truth, right? The future of Windows development is XAML development, period, right? There was a lot of confusion in the past around what the next technology will be. There's no confusion anymore, right? And so I love that. I mean, I've been a XAML developer since the beginning. I love XAML with a passion, right? I just rub it in my hair, kind of. I love it. And so today we'll supercharge your XAML, supercharge your UI with XAML, right? With just some techniques that I'll bet most of you know half of them. A fourth of you know all of them, right? And so try not to embarrass me, right? I just want to make sure we all have really these great samples. There's a couple of things that I didn't do that are I just don't have time for, right? I've only got 75 minutes. I want to show everything that's going on. And so I'll do what I can. And then I'll ask for questions anytime. So don't feel like you can't ask a question. It doesn't have to be about what I'm showing. It can be just something that you're thinking about that you want to talk about as well. How many people, let me ask some quick questions just to level set. How many people consider themselves today a XAML developer? All of you. That's fantastic. A couple of you are wondering. How many of you started with WPF or use WPF today or have ever used WPF? Almost the same. How many went to Silverlight? Okay. About, I'd say, two-thirds of you. How many are still using Silverlight today? Yeah, that's real. That's totally real, right? How many people use WinRT XAML in the Windows runtime? Most of my samples are going to be in the Windows runtime, not because they're only supported there, just because that's where everything future is headed, right? And so I'm doing that as well. Not that anything's being left behind. The next version of WPF is going to be a major rev, so it'll be fine. I have a couple of samples in WPF as well. How many people use on a daily basis, like they open it, let's say, twice a week, Visual Studio 2008? Two of you. Sometimes you have to, right, for SSRS or something. How many people used Visual Studio 2010? Every day or once or twice a week? All right, very small. 2012 or 13? Everybody else. All right, good. Yeah, me too. Okay. How many people, out of curiosity, how many people leave it in the original gray color when they install? Most of you. Isn't that funny? We complain so much, and then we got used to it. Okay. Great. So I'm a developer evangelist. I work for Microsoft. I live in Colorado. A developer evangelist is just a friend to developers, right? It's really great. Hopefully you've seen a handful of us here. I don't know the local developer evangelist, actually, to point you to it. But here's what we're going to try and cover, and this is a lot to talk about quickly. There's some extra stuff at the end that I'll just talk about just as a list. And rather than looking at this, let's just jump right into it. How did we get here? Let's talk about the history of XAML in 30 seconds, as quickly as possible so we can kind of be up to speed. In 2006, WPF was released. WPF is the big brother, the granddaddy, however you want to think about it. It's the major superset of XAML. And then in 2007, just a year later, Silverlight was released for the browser. And then it continued on until about a year ago, right? And then in 2009, Silverlight was then ported over so it worked on the Xbox. And every time you deployed your application, you were basically porting the entire framework with your application. It was great. And then in 2010, Windows Phone 7 was released, and it had its own version of Silverlight, right? Basically the same syntax, a few things slightly tweaked. And then along came Jupyter for Windows Runtime in 2011. And so those are all of the major releases of XAML across the way. Everything else is a point release. So right now we're in 4.5.2, I think, of WPF. Is that right? 4.5.2? Yeah. And so I don't know what the next number will be, but it'll be a good release as well. And then we're not really giving numbers to the Jupyter implementation, and more just kind of fits the whatever version of Windows you're running it on. So here's where we are. For the most part, the syntax across all the different flavors of XAML, and really there's only three, right? There's only WPF, Silverlight, and Jupyter. There's really only three. And I call it WinRT XAML. Some people call it the Windows Runtime XAML, XAML for Windows Runtime. It's tough, right? It used to be like Metro XAML, remember those days? And so things just kind of come and go, and that's the way it goes. And I don't anticipate any enormous releases. We do know that XAML is coming to Xbox One. That was announced, but I still don't know the timing of it. Okay, so what is XAML? No, that's not what this is going to be about. If you're looking for an introduction to XAML, I'm sorry, there's just no time. Right? There's so much to XAML. But I want to tell you that on Microsoft Virtual Academy, which is microsoftvirtualacademy.com, there's hours and hours of training that I've created. So those five courses right there are all the ones that I've created. Each one of those, some of them are 16 hours, some of them are individually 8 hours. And so you can listen to me talk for weeks on end right there. And we can go into as much detail as you want to from the XAML side. How many people have watched one of those, or at least a little bit of one of those? Most of you. Well, that's fantastic. All right. Let's get past all the history. Let's go straight to the demos. Now, I have so much to show you in so little time that so yesterday I was going through the demos and I couldn't get them compressed. I couldn't type fast enough, basically, right? I'm like, I got to show more. I wanted to show as much as possible. So there might be a little bit of trick that I'm going through up here, but you'll see what I'm doing. It'll be okay. I don't want to pretend, but it's going to be great. All right. So I want to start with vector composition, and I want to talk about specifically the fact that inside XAML, I can draw objects using the path, and I can draw objects that are completely vector and scale independent. So no matter what the quality of resolution that you have in your device, whatever your monitor shows, it's always going to be beautiful, right? So I can always bring in a rastered bitmap, and that rastered bitmap is going to be pixelated as I go up in quality and increase the quality of the resolution. That will never happen to a vector, and so I can draw all the vectors, and I'll show you this in here in just a second. And there's a lot of tools you can use. I'm going to use Expression Design. Expression Design is still out there. It's free for you to download. It used to be part of the Expression Suite before it was deprecated. But Expression Design is still beautiful. It still allows you to do basically everything you do in Adobe Illustrator. And by the way, if you want to use Adobe Illustrator, go for it, right? That's just as nice. But I'll use Expression Design, and I'll show you that here in just a second. All right, and then we'll retemplate some things. So I'll start with a blank project here. And this is going to be a WPF project, and it will... The reason I'll use WPF here, this will be the only one I'll use that's WPF, but because XAML is pretty much universal, we can go to town here. I'm going to retemplate a text box, and so every control has a template property. I'll set it up at the beginning, and I'll put some initial text here as well. There we go. Okay. So far, so good. Now I'm going to launch Expression Design. Just like Adobe Illustrator, Expression Design allows me to create a vector-based image. And so first thing, I'm just going to draw something. I want a retemplate, and so this is going to be an elephant that I'm going to draw. Right? Hopefully you can see that. It's just an elephant. It looks like he's facing the wrong way. So I can just drop him back behind. Again, this is all for you, right? You can use the same tool. And you don't have to use an elephant, by the way. You can make it be anything that you want. A little tail here that doesn't fill. There we go. Okay. Now, let's make it so that he talks, because this is going to be a text box. And so I'll draw, this is a text bubble, right? You know the kind. You practice this enough, and it gets become very, very easy. You can start drawing it however you want. Now watch this cool feature. I'll select everything that I just drew. And now up in the edit command, I can say copy XAML. That's the big deal right now. So I can copy out the XAML. and maybe it'll fit the version of XAML that I'm using, maybe it won't, and I'll have to tweak it. All right, so this is easiest to do inside Blend. So I'm going to open up the same XAML file, but I'm going to use expression Blend. Remember, it ships with Visual Studio now. You all have Blend. And if you don't use Blend, you totally should, right? So I'll edit the template of the text box. So this is me changing the way the text box looks. I'm going to use a style to do it. That's how I'll start it, but we'll change it here in just a second. So we'll call it the elephant box, and the elephant box style at the scope of the application. So now I'm inside of it, and you can see I have all of the visual states that I would have with any text box, mouse over, disabled, read-only. I haven't lost any of that just because I've exported the style. It's a copy of the original. So you can see it's all set up here inside the application scope so that it's totally global. All right, so now I'm going to paste in what I copied from design. You see, it's all the paths are done there for me, and all that complexity is kind of hidden away. All right, so here I'm going to take the same text box. This is the content of the text box, and just make sure that it's over in the text bubble instead. All right, inside Visual Studio, I can see that I've referenced it as a dynamic resource. Of course, there are no dynamic resources in WinRT, but it shouldn't matter. And now as I change its vertical alignment and its horizontal content alignment, you can see it's the text that gets reordered because I haven't lost any of the properties or any of the capabilities that I have from a text box just because I reskin it. Okay, so I'm going to change it so that the layout that it's in is now inside a stack panel because I want to add another text box. So here's the second text box. It's kind of hard to tell them apart. All right, so the top one is text box, and the bottom one here is going to be elephant. And I can bind what the elephant says, just like I can do any element binding. I can bind what the element says up to the text box. So the two are connected and always have the same things. Right. So I'll change its update source to property change so it's an immediate effect. Here's my window. And I can change it to say, hello, world. And you can kind of see the rest of the elephant here. Right. So that's a full text box, no functionality change at all, just looks different for you. Right? That's the whole idea. Still a text box, same events, same properties, same everything, just restyled. But maybe I don't want to change it based on styling, so let me add a new controls folder here, and I'll just add a quick class so I can subclass the text box. Maybe I want to change it so that I have additional properties, or additional methods, or additional events. So all I have to do is inherit from the text box. But in this case, I'm going to use the default style key. This basically says never make this look like a text box. Always make it look like whatever style was built for the elephant box. Right? So here's my elephant box. No changes yet. And so I'll drag it over from my toolbox here, and I'll delete the one I have here. Right? And so it's exactly the same right below it. I haven't associated the style yet. So let me go back. You can see it's set up right now for just the text box. I need to make a reference to the namespace up in the namespaces. And so I can say now it's targeting specifically the elephant box. I no longer need a key. That way every elephant box is going to look the same. You can see it's already implemented the way that it's supposed to look, no changes yet. Every time I drag one out of the toolbox now, it's always going to look like this elephant. Right, so no changes at all, at least not yet. I'll update it so the font's a little bit bigger so you guys can see it, so it looks basically the same as before. And now let me bind it, just like I did before. I'm going to make a binding over to the text box above it, just to its text property, nothing else. There you go. Now, the binding doesn't have to be two-way because I haven't enabled that yet. But from this point of view, I can take any control. In fact, it's worth noting that every control in the XAML toolbox has a template property to it, with the exception of text block and a couple others that don't really have a UI around it. And I can re template any property that way. And so if you look at how I'm changing it, all I'm doing is setting its template to a new template that I create. And then it's up to me to finish the implementation so that it has the full text box capability as well. Do I want it to look like an elephant? Maybe not. Maybe I want it to look like a flag. Maybe I want it to look like a car. Maybe I need it to look like a currency, because that's where the user types. There's really no reason I have to stick with the out-of-the-box visual that comes out of Visual Studio. Every single control that I drag out of the toolbox in Visual Studio already has a template associated to it, and I can override all every time. The problem is there are two things to consider. One, all of the visual functionality is now up to you. Because I copied the template or copied its style, I got all of the original that was there so I could just kind of tweak it. But I could start deleting stuff, making sure that I didn't have certain visual states, removing functionality from the UI. So it's really up to you to make sure if you're going to make your text box look like an elephant, that you implement all the functionality. What does an elephant look like when he's disabled, right? What does an elephant look like when he's read-only? What does an elephant look like when he has focus, right? Maybe all those things you're going to need to have a visual impact for. That's great. That's totally up to you from this point forward, because I've overridden the out-of-the-box template, and the original template now is gone, right? So now that's the second thing, and this is worth considering also, is the idea around accessibility. All the original templates that come out of the text box, or it's come out of the toolbox, right? All that has been tested for accessibility. So if you need a screen reader in order to see and interact with a UI, if you need special tooling, if you need things that interact with it, all of that accessibility is taken care of out of the box. As soon as I override the template, all that accessibility is now at my control, and I can ruin it very, very quickly, right? The easiest thing to do is take away functionality. So as soon as I may have made it look really interesting and compelling here, but perhaps to somebody who's visually impaired, this is very, very difficult, right? Maybe it's very, very difficult. So I need to pay attention to that as well. I did this very quickly and very simply, and so I would need to pay attention to accessibility as well. Having said that, this is an awesome way to show text as well, right? This is a great way to visualize it. Maybe you're not going to use an elephant, but you can use something. That's the idea. So there's no reason to stick to the original templates unless you're just really wanting to. Okay, I used Expression Design. It's the last version, right? It's the last version. And so the great functionality around it is I can copy as XAML. The downside is that XAML usually targets Silverlight, and there's no updates to this product coming, which mean every once in a while, I have to go in and I have to make changes to make sure that it works for the Windows runtime. If you're copying this for WPF or you're copying this for Silverlight, you'll never have problems, right? The great thing is it allows me to draw the whole vector piece. I could scale in, scale out, and it would always look like that beautiful elephant. I could change the style, which is what I did here, and I could invoke the style globally so that the style itself writes the template, or I could manually just say control.template equals or control.template inside the tag, inside my XAML, and just define the template right there. So it's kind of up to me. But remember, as soon as you're doing that, it's not just as quick as I did it. There's more work behind the scenes to make sure that you have all of its functionality. Okay. If you're a web developer today, you already know that your application is going to show up on devices that are different sizes. That's exactly the same for especially modern applications written in XAML that allow me to project my application onto anything. I can put it on my phone, I can put it on a tablet, I can put it on a device like this. I can put it on an 80-inch screen, right? It doesn't matter where I put it. And what's great is the resolution independence of XAML means that the 2-inch by 2-inch box that I create is always going to be 2 inch by 2 inches, no matter what size screen it is. So that part is handled for me, and it's beautiful. But as the screen gets bigger and the screen gets bigger, what I want to do is make sure that I don't just stretch my UI. Because the reason I bought a gigantic monitor for my desk was not so that your app could just get really big, right? I got it because I want to see a lot more data at the same time. So your application needs to be able to respond to that change in size. Maybe the change is only on load, right? Maybe the change is dynamic like it is for Windows 8 so that I can snap things to the left and to the right and make them even smaller if I want to. So I have an application that I put together so that you can kind of get a see for it here. Let's see. All right, so I have it right here. And so let me run it just so we can get a gist of what this application looks like. It's just it's a mock-up, a really simplistic mock-up of what you might see maybe a mail application or something, some sort of master details list that you would have inside your app, right? Whatever that is. And so it's just dummy data here along the way, right? And so you scroll right here so I can pick whatever it is I want to see, and then I can read whatever is in the document as well. That's the entire application, so it doesn't do any kind of functionality. Now, what happens when the user then snaps it to the left, right? So the first option is not just that it goes half of the screen, right? The first option is that it goes in portrait mode. So there's not just sizing that I get to think about, but there's also orientation change as well. And so I could take my tablet and turn it on its side, and now it's in portrait mode. And so you as a designer now, right, because XAML developers aren't just developers, we're also designers, right? It's just in our blood, right, because we know we can do anything. And so when we turn it sideways, we have to think, what's the best user experience as well? Maybe it's as simple as just reducing the font, maybe making sure there's enough space, and that's it. Maybe you actually reorient and change the layout a little bit as well. That's totally okay, and it's totally up to you. In my case, if I go to half screen, hopefully you saw what happened, right? On the left, this little picker here, right, got quite a bit more narrow, and the font got smaller as well. And the header at the top got smaller. The fonts over here got a little bit smaller, just to make sure everything fits. That's the entire goal, right? And so if I take it back, hopefully you can see just the quick shift. It's not growing in size. I'm actually changing font size and different pieces like that. Now remember, there are three orientations that I have to support. The first one is going to be landscape. In a sense, there are six orientations, especially if you include the phone for universal applications. But let's just talk about it like this for now. So the first is going to be landscape, and so that's the full screen. The second one is going to be this portrait mode, but basically where the width is more narrow than the height. And that's great. And then I also have the very narrow, right? The very narrow. And so the very narrow basically allows me to grab and take it in. By default, the limit to an application that you build on Windows is 500 pixels wide. But I can go in, and you can too, and change it so that you support 320 pixels. And that 320 pixel, that very narrow, kind of maps to the original Windows 8.0 spec that allowed me to snap to the left, right? There's no more snapping anymore. I use that word just because I'm so accustomed to it. But now you can see it stops right there. That's 320 pixels. And if I stop, it's completely changed its UI. And the way that I do that, what it's really doing here, right? It still has this list. Didn't really have to make very many changes to the list. And then when I select an individual, there's no room anymore on the right. I could add animation if I wanted to as it transitions to this. But nonetheless, so now I have the full document so that I can scan it right here. And then I can, when I back up, it takes me back to the list. That makes sense because I need to make use of all the real estate that I do. There's a handful of ways for me to support this, but let me show you the one that'll make your life as easy as possible. And so here is, let's see. Here is my solution. And I want to show the couple of things that make sense here. So I've got a simple layout. I do everything MVVM, right? Everything's model, view, view model, even my demos. And they're just super lightweight, so don't judge me, right? There's a lot of shortcuts that I'm taking to make these as quick as possible. But at the same time, I wanted to make it at least halfway realistic for a type of app that you may be building, right? And so I have my views in my view folder. I have my view models in my view folder, right? So I've got my main page, and that's what I want to show you. The view model itself is almost nothing at all, right? It just has a list of documents and whether or not it's selected. So I don't really care to look at that. I only want to show you the view anyway because I want to talk about responsive design. So I open up the view, right? I want to show you that I am implementing a behavior already. And so I've identified a visual state. In fact, this is going to be a lot easier if I show it to you in Blend because visual states are easier to edit when I'm inside Blend. So I create three visual states, one to handle each of the visual states, right? One of the views that I'm going to support. And so I will pull this back and let you see, right? And so up here in the states tab, I can see that I've got 5 states. I've really got 3 and then 2 sub-states. So the first state is this landscape state that I'm seeing right here. The next one is going to be the portrait state. And so it looks a little funny in a landscape model, but I can go into the devices tab and switch it to be portrait and get an idea of how this is going to lay out for the user. Then I can go in again to the states, and I can go down and I can set up it's narrow, which again looks a little bit funny, but if I wanted to, I could switch this back and show it as narrow, right? So I can take this and I can grab let me switch to the other side. I can grab the slider here, right, and bring it all the way down to 320 and get a feel for what it's going to look like as well. And then inside the states, I've also got these nested states, one of choosing and one of reading. Remember, I have 2 places to go inside the narrow view. One is just the screen itself. So I don't have any code behind working for me. I did all this inside a custom behavior that easily you could steal from me and adjust it to match your needs exactly, right? And I would say 50%, 75% of you may be able to take this behavior and just use it, right? And with no changes whatsoever. But when you see how simplistic it is, you'll be able to make your own as well. And I have another tip here at the end where we'll talk about building a custom behavior. But let me show you where I put my behaviors in a behavior folder. And basically, in fact, I've pulled it up to look at a class diagram. And let me look at the class diagram. Where I get to set the landscape, the narrow, and the portrait states. So those are those 3 top states that I showed you in Blend. The landscape, the portrait, and the narrow. Each of those, I've attached here's the responsive behavior. I've attached them. Let me grab this just a little. There we go. And I've set them up here so I can grab whichever state is appropriate. So this is the landscape state, narrow, and portrait. And then I get to determine whether or not there's a narrow width and what that's going to be. If I don't want to have it extremely narrow, I might set that. I may not set it to anything, right? I might set it to 0 or leave it at that but not provide a narrow visual state. Or I could set it to 500 and have that be my narrow. Totally fine. So now, as things occur, it's the behavior doing all of the work. And again, I can go to all of the code all the code behind here, and there's really no implementation at all because I've declared it all inside my XAML. Right? So here's the declaration of it right here. This is my behaviors. This is my custom responsive behavior. You can see it's just setting up that landscape, narrow, and portrait state and what its name is. It does all the hunting for me. It finds it and transitions to it for me. So this handles responsive design for you, but there's a couple other things for you to consider. One is when I do a transition from one visual state to another, it's a storyboard that actually executes. Now, this is exciting. There's some changes coming to that where it might be just a property setter that's coming, but right now it's a storyboard. And so sometimes not all properties can be changed in a storyboard, right? You need to change them another way. And maybe you have to create a proxy class that holds those values for you. And so what I didn't do it here, but one of the things I easily could have done is make a custom C# class with dependency properties that hold the let's say font size. You know, I'd make this class specific maybe for my main page, and it would hold all the properties for all the variables that switch around between different view states. As it changes, I'm changing that class, and I have all of the UI that I've defined bound to that proxy class, right? That's another option that makes it really easy for me, and I could also implement some extra logic if I wanted. Okay, so that's the idea around responsive design. You build your application not just so it scales up and it looks beautiful with fantastic resolution, but also so as the user starts changing their devices. Now, this is a big deal even with WPF, although most WPF developers, to be honest, assume their application is going to be full screen and assume the monitor is going to be some resolution that's set by their enterprise, right? So you think about this maybe just a little bit less. But the reality is now even enterprises are changing with bring your own devices. And so as users bring their own device, and it's going to be on a tablet now, bring their own device, it's going to be on a Surface or whatever, and they start turning it and snapping it, this same sort of action still occurs. And if you don't control it, all of a sudden your user experience is terrible, right? There's just no getting past it. All right. So that's the idea around responsive design. And I'll just say, one of the nice things about using a behavior is that there's no logic in the view model itself. I didn't have any properties in my view model that said, this is the change in the orientation. I didn't have any properties in the view model that said, this is what the font size should be. The view model is really not about that, right? The view model is really about exposing the data up to the view. The view model doesn't have access to the window or the size change event. Of course, it can, and we know that it's within scope so that it could. But generally thinking about that, that's not where the logic belongs, right? So that's what's nice about a behavior. One more thing about that that we're just pointing out is tomorrow I'll be teaching a client. If you don't know much about MVVM, tomorrow I'll be teaching another session just on implementing MVVM using Prism for MVVM, right? So Prism is super lightweight when it's used with the Windows Store. And so anyway, that's another session tomorrow. One other thing that's worth noting, and if you're a web developer, you already know these concepts. And so this is the sizing of things inside of a grid. And so that blue, those two blue boxes over on the right really represent the way that that UI is designed. On the left, it's auto, and auto basically means if it needs the space, it'll give it the space. And if it doesn't need the space, it won't give any space at all, right? So it's totally collapsed until it requests it. On the right is star, which basically says, I don't care how much space you need, I'm taking everything I can get, right? And so I have pixel, auto, and star. And so pixel is just very exact, right? I need it to be 200 pixels forever, right? That's fine. And remember, it's not pixels. It really translates into inches or the metric system. And so then the green section down below is really where it comes to this, the R, the way it, 1, 2, and 3 R inside a table inside HTML. So HTML5 allows you to have that same kind of proportional relationship between columns or rows. So in this case, the 2-star is going to be twice as wide as the 1-star. Right? And so I created a 2-1-1 that really separates it into 4, if you think about it, with the first one call spanning 2 of them. That's the idea. All right. So now to the radio layout. This is a fun one. You guys are going to like this. It's really just a matter of setting it up. And so let me create a third demo project. And this time I'm going to do it inside a Windows Blank app. So this will just be demo 3. And I'm going to set up everything kind of from the scratch, but as quickly as possible so that you can get a feel for how it's laid out. So I'll create just a common, because remember, this is just going to be a setup. And I'm going to want bindable base. And bindable base, I've got a snippet here that allows me to just create it. Bindable base is the same that comes with the Visual Studio templates. So nothing special there. You can get that on your own as well. You probably already have your own, to be honest. So nothing special inside it. I'm going to create a models folder with my item inside it. This is my base model. It'll have two properties. It'll have three properties. It'll have an angle as well as the idea of a reverse angle. And so let me just set up, that's just going to be the negative of whatever the angle is set up to be. So just three quick properties of text, angle, and reverse angle, right? So let me create the view model now for my main page. This is the main page view model. Again, very simplistic, but I do need to go ahead and inherit from common.bindable-base. That'll allow me to have that iNotify property change. And so first, this is going to basically be a setup for a clock, and I'll show you how to do it. So first I'll have the second, the minute, and the hour angle. And then I'll have a collection of just items. That's that model that we created together. The first one is for second ticks. I'll create my using here. And then the next one is just going to be a collection of hours ticks. There we go. Okay, so those are all the properties, and I want to have some default information inside it. Again, the constructor runs in the designer, so it's really great. So I'll put this in the constructor on purpose, but of course I couldn't have asynchronous operations. So I'll use a dispatcher timer, and every time that it ticks, I'm basically going to tell it to update whatever the second angle is, right? So the second angle is basically datetime.now, whatever the seconds is, but I have to translate that into 360 divided by 60. All right, so that's every angle around a circle. The minutes are exactly the same as seconds. Hours are a little different because there's only 12 positions. So I'll do 12. There we go. So those are the different angles that I've calculated for each of the different, for where the second hand, the minute hand, and the hour hand. Now I want to add those ticks in. So for to 4 I to 60, right? So I'm going to create a second tick. This is just going to be that little line that represents what the second is. So whatever its text is, really we're not going to do anything for second. There we go, got to get my namespace. But we'll just put in its numeric value anyway, even though we won't show that in the UI. Angle is calculated the same, 360 divided by its 60 seconds, or its 60 possible positions. I'll add that to, for each of those, I'll add it to my collection. Then I'll do 12, but this time it's for the hour marker in my clock. And so the angle is going to be very important here, because I'll use it to fix the text. In this case, we won't have a 0 hour, we'll go straight to 12. And because there are 12 positions, we'll divide by 12 as well. All right, so now I have two sets of ticks. I have, hang on a second. Now I have two sets of tick marks, and now it's just a matter of setting up the UI. So I'll open up the XAML. I won't do any more in code. Nothing else really matters. I will start by setting my data context. Remember, this is a dependency property, so it flows down through the rest of my page for me automatically. And so I'll start by just setting a container that this will go in. 400 by 400 will be the base of my clock. And then the base repeater for XAML is the items control. So you can see it's already put all the hours in for me, but it hasn't laid them out the way that I want them to. I'll start by changing what container it's in. The items panel defaults to a stack panel, as you can see. I'm going to change that to a grid. So as soon as I change it to a grid, everything just sits on top of each other. And so that's great, because I want to start moving them around so that they fit onto the clock. So in this case, I'll say items control, or the item template, just the data template, is going to be a grid that fills the entire space with a text block that has the number for that hour, right? So it's just text of the value. So you can kind of see the numbers up there. Let me make it a little bigger. So the number, they're all sitting on top of each other. I need it in the center. All right, so over here I'm going to use a render transform, and I'm going to bind its rotation angle. Binding the rotation angle allows me to move it around the clock. So I'll bind it to the angle, which is already calculated for me. So here's everything. Each one of them gets their own angle, so each one of them goes into a different location. And now I'm going to bind the rotation of the text block to the reverse, because I don't want them all to look sideways. I want them all to go up, right? So one is a negative angle, one is a positive angle, and they just reverse rotate the opposite. Beautiful. All right, so now I can just copy this, and I'll use the same logic, basically, but I'll do it now for the second marks, or the second little ticks, right? So I don't need a text block. What I really need is a line, and a line is, I'll make it stroke white and its thickness, or its stroke thickness, 4, which means x1 will start at 2, because I want it to be in the middle. And then x2 will also end at 2, right? Half of its thickness. I'll go to y1. This is where it's going to actually begin. I'll say let's start at 0. And if it's just a little tick, it's 10. And then y as well. So now you can see they're a little bit split. I've not bound to the right item source here. So if I bind it to the second tick, there we go. Now there's plenty of them. And let's see, I need to now rotate so that the line, there we go. So now it's not bound, now it's no longer in the corner, so it's at an angle. Now it's back into the middle. All right, so here are all the seconds. That padding is a little, that margin is a little much. Let me back that up. All right, that's a lot more like a clock, right? This is just a simple radial layout. All I'm doing is changing the items panel to a grid so I can do anything to it. Now let's add a quick line. Remember, I added the three properties of the second hand, the hour hand, and the minute hand. So another white line here. We'll make this one nice and big. Since it's 10, obviously x1 is going to go to 5. That's halfway in. That way it's centered. And then we'll make this one 170. Hang on. Make it, I'm going to center it. See how it's in the top left? So it's just a little, I just need to make it so that it's centered instead. So center. Now I can't go to the, I have to go a negative 175. There you go. So that's a line. Now it's just a matter, since it's all centered, I can rotate it real easily. I'll do that here in just a second. And so a little bit shorter one, I'll change it to silver. That'll be the one we'll use for hours. And then I'll copy the long one again and put it right behind them all because I want seconds never to hide what time it is. So we'll make it red. That's sort of the universal for seconds here. So here I'll go back over to the angle of rotation. And now I can bind it directly to, in this case, it'll be second angle, right? That's that property that gets updated every time. And look how it happens even while I'm in the designer, because the dispatch timer is executing inside the constructor. And I'll do the same thing for minute, and then I'll set up the rotation angle for hour as well. So let me just bind that to my view model's hour angle. Beautiful. So it's a simple enough radial. There's no reason you couldn't build a radial layout, right? It's not that difficult. And all I really have to do is start changing all the base implementation of my application. I have to calculate my own angle. By the way, I could have made it so that it spirals out. I could have done all kinds of easy things because the bulk of the logic is back when the object is being created, right? I don't have to put it in the XAML and create something complex to do all the work for me and make it so everything is genericized. I make it specific for the type of object that I'm creating here. Not tremendously complicated, but the result is super awesome, right? I mean, it really does look neat, and why just have the numbers across? That's nice. So I have an app I'll show you. I wrote this app to help me when I'm doing presentations, and I did it the exact same way, right? So this is, I calculate the angle and I make that little piece of pie, follow my mouse around based on that. And then of course I just put those numbers doing exactly what we just did together. And so then when I let off, whichever one I'm closest to, it just changes to it. I really like this UI. I'm sort of addicted to it. I could change the time all the time. It's kind of great. And then it flips down. It's amazing too, but that's not part of the demo, but it's pretty great. All right. So. How do you do a UI like that just like we did, right? It's not this, the complexity behind it really isn't crazy. 360 divided by the number of positions around the circle and you're done, right? That's pretty great. Pretty great. All right, so that was pretty cool. That's another neat thing you can do. I love the idea of taking normal layouts and then changing them so that they fit and make a very unique experience for what you're doing, right? That's the idea. All right, so now it's the idea of a pixel-perfect layout. So we all know that half of us half of our mind is a designer and half of our other mind is as a developer, right? Just the way it goes. We're not full designers, otherwise we'd all be wearing turtlenecks, you know, and that's not what we do. And so instead, we have this pixel-perfect layout requirement, especially in Windows applications. Back with WPF, we had the ability to make things beautiful and awesome. Pixel-perfect wasn't always in our vocabulary, right? We just made them, if we could do it, we'd do it, right? If we could make things shiny, they would shine, and it was great. And, you know, as the design language became more and more clear, one of the things for sure was attention to detail. And so as you make changes, and I'll show you here in just a second, as you make changes to your UI to match what your designer is putting together, something they do inside like Photoshop, for example, that you want to match that as well, sometimes you're surprised that you can't, right? There really are certain things that are very, very difficult. And so the biggest issue is the idea around subpixeling. And so subpixeling is like this. Imagine I am 2 pixels wide, just for the sake of it. I guess I'm 2 pixels wide. And so 1, 2. But imagine I have 3 pixels to fit into. No problem, right? I'm right on these, right? Or I'm right over here. No big deal. But now imagine that you want to center me, right? How are you going to center me, right? Well, the reality is to accomplish centering, we subpixel, right? So subpixel means I'm fully in the middle pixel and I'm half in the other two. But a pixel is just a pixel, so I can't be half in the other two. All I really am is anti-aliased, so that I'm fuzzy on the right, on the left and right, right? So now I've sort of matched a way that the UI is supposed to look, but I've made it look really crappy at the same time because I've taken it so instead of this nice crisp edge, now I have this really sloppy, blurry edge that everybody thinks we all need new monitors to make it look better, but the reality is I've messed up my application by not thinking about pixel perfect, or by not thinking about sub-pixeling. The idea, but the reality is, I do want that to happen sometimes, right? I do want things to be smooth. I do like the way some things look. But every once in a while, it's wrong, especially when you think about something on the outside that fits perfect, and I'm on the inside, but I don't fit correctly, right? So let's look at that. All right. So I have another project here. Let me close this and this. All right. The XAML is super simple. In fact, I think it'll be a lot easier to see this in Blend as well. So I'll go ahead and pop this open inside Blend. Big fan of Blend, by the way. Big fan. Next version of Blend, woo, get ready, man. It is nice. It's really nice. All right, so I'm zoomed in as far as I can go. I wish I could go even further. There's two circles. Let me drop to the XAML just to show it. There's two ellipses, two circles, right? Each about the same size, each centered, and that's it. Nothing special, just a couple, some colors and all. So if I were to show you, hopefully you can already start to see the problem, right? You can start to see that they are not actually centered at all. In fact, the one on the yellow looks as if it's fallen down to the bottom and the right, but it's not. It's centered, right? It's completely centered. And anybody know what's causing this to happen? Layout rounding is causing this to happen. So layout rounding is a function of XAML that says if I ever fall in between two pixels like that, just round to the whole number, right? Just make it right. Well, all of a sudden, remember, I'm two pixels wide and there's three that I go in. I say center me, but I automatically fall over to one side. It's the way it happens no matter what. And so this is, if I were to be honest with you, right, and back up, this is extremely small, right? We're talking about a single pixel, so it's extremely small. The normal user's eye might or might not see this. A designer's eye will see it every time, and they'll just reject it and send it back to you, and it's annoying, right? And so now it's like, well, how do I solve this problem? Well, you would think you would go in and just disable layout rounding, right? You would think it would be that easy. You would almost be right, by the way. The problem is layout rounding, and so this is an interesting differentiation between WPF and Windows. So in WPF, layout rounding is off by default, right? So that means things naturally go into the middle and look blurry for WPF. Have you ever written a WPF app and you can't quite figure out why the text is hard to read? That might be because you have default, you're keeping the default layout rounding and allowing it to subpixel. So when Windows XAML came out, layout rounding defaulted to false. Let me see. Am I saying this right? Yeah, I'm saying that right. No, it's defaulted to true, right? So it always rounds to the whole pixel. That allows me to create a Windows application in XAML, never have to think about it, and nothing is ever blurry as a result, right? That's what's important. However, it also means I get this thing happening. And this is extremely important when you have a very detailed UI, right? Because sometimes, depending on what the color is, two colors too close together can actually cause a color shift. And the user sees something different than what's actually there. And so the way to fix this, there's two core ways that you can fix this situation. The first is not to use tiny little elements. I mean, that seems obvious. Sometimes you can't get away from it, but if you can make it bigger, this pixeling won't even matter, right? Right now, there's only two pixels between those two different circles, but if I were to make it so there are 15 between them, you wouldn't be able to visually see the difference between 14 and 15 pixels. It's just the way it works. But the other way is to turn off layout rounding. But you don't turn it off on the item, because if I were to go to this item and go to its properties and change layout rounding, right? You see it's defaulted on because I'm in a Windows project, right? If I turn that off, there's nothing fixed. The reality is, even if I turn the next one off, there's nothing fixed. Because what it's really doing is being set inside its parent, and the parent is calculating the location. Everything then inside this will be calculated based on its using layout rounding property as well. So instead, you go to the parent. I could turn them off individually and try and tweak them, but pretty soon it would be the opposite. They would go the other way, right? And you would still be incorrect. So in order to allow subpixeling, I have to go back to the parent. So you can see over here in my outline, I can go up to the grid that they all sit in, and as soon as I uncheck it, it corrects. It corrects very subtly. The reason you're not seeing a difference is also because when I was playing with it just then showing you, I manually set it in this by mistake. So there we go. Now you can really see the difference. Are you all struggling to see it? Because I don't see it either. This is not the way it's supposed to go. This is not right. This is not good. This, my first demo fail here. Oh, no. Here's the line. And here's a line. Here's a line. These little guides are nice, by the way. I don't know if you've ever used these guides in Blend, but they allow you to get things just right. Well, for Pete's sake. Dang. I could do it like this, but that's really cheating. Because what I did was I made it so the pixels are even instead of odd, but dang it. Just trust me, that is the right way to do it. It's the way we do it inside our controls. You know, our controls sometimes are really tiny. Well, don't hate me. All right, here we go. We're done with that one for now. That's the idea. I don't want to spend too much time because it only happens in very small cases. Get it? Sorry. All right. So that's the idea around Pixel Perfect, and it's worth at least pointing out this idea. You can grab them just from any toolbar and bring them down. This is truly the way we being Microsoft, enabled you to be Pixel Perfect as well, where you might take an image that your designer creates, put it over your application, draw all your lines, then delete that image. Now you have all these lines exactly where items are supposed to go. You can even go in and individually tweak them. You can see this little box right here. I go in there and tweak that to make sure, and I could switch its location, its affinity, so it's on the left or it's bound to the right. So as things scale, it's always 40 from the margin, whichever side it's supposed to be on. And then I can export these lines. Or if I were a designer, or if I were working with junior developers, right, I could export these lines, give it to my development team, and say, import these lines and make it match every single time. And if it doesn't match, maybe you have layout rounding on, which may not work. Right. All right, perfect. So this is the idea around layout rounding. It takes away the anti-aliasing. And I swear I was doing this just last night, and it was beautiful. So I did something backwards. The thing worth remembering is where the default actually is and that it's different in WPF. I believe the default is actually improved as we've gone into regular Windows runtime XAML so that it defaults to true. That means everything rounds up to the nearest and you don't get blurs, right? That's the idea. But you can always force it if you need things to move over if they need to. All right. Excuse me. Custom items control. All right, so the items control, we showed that earlier, customizing the items control for the radial menu. You know, we can make any kind of change we want. What if we made a whole bunch of changes? And so let me pull up right here, right? And so look at this cool UI. It's breathtaking, right? So this has a list of trucks. So I follow trucks and cars and things like that. Let's say maybe I have a whole fleet out in the field that I need to keep track of. This is how I would do it, right? And they would come in, and here's my whole list of all the trucks. And as I select it, vehicle 5 is selected, right? I can go on down, and I can say, this is a simple list box. Nothing special. You guys have done this before. It's just a simple list box bound to a list with a simple text block inside it. But we're back to visualizing things inside XAML, right? The idea is I have XAML that it can do anything. Why would I take this out-of-the-box experience, which is okay, right? I don't want to say anything's wrong with it. But when I could do so much more, look at all the information I need to provide, right? I'm saying let's pretend that's latitude and longitude. So I'll show it's latitude and longitude, and I'm trying to show all that. I kind of need multiple columns, to be honest, to show that just right. But why show that tabular like columns when, honestly, that data is not that important to me? And what is the number? Look at truck number 3 that I have highlighted. That's at 242. What does that even mean to me? If that were a full latitude, it would mean even less, right? It gets so small. It just doesn't mean anything to the user as they see it. So I want to see this a little bit differently. And so over on the right, I've got the same thing. This is just a text box. Sorry, this is just a list box. And so they're bound to the same data, right? That's why they're both moving at the same time. But this one I want to start making some subtle changes to, just so it makes sense to me. And so let me close that. Right, so here's my list box. And so let me show you the definition. I'll start by saying, here's the default list box. Nothing special, almost at all, right? Just a text box that shows some text. All right. Now, what if I instead created a special list box, right? A special list box, and I'll start. So just know, first of all, this is just a list box. And I'll show you what I changed. And it's one method, and it's really not all that much. Oh, it might be a lot, but I don't think it's much. I don't want to make it sound like it's all so simple. But I'll start by just changing the background. So all I did was change the background of the list box and nothing else. Well, that's sort of nice. My fleet, as it turns out, is all in Barcelona. Isn't that convenient? I didn't know we were going to have TechEd here, and here my fleet's in Barcelona. It's really great. And so that's not true, but it's fun, right? And so I can see the data is still behind it. The first one is selected, and it still looks like regular, and I don't like that. But I don't want, obviously, the list to be stacked on top of each other. Remember that the items panel, the default, is a stack panel, right? And so I'll change it now because I want it to be canvas. Remember what we used last time? It was grid. I don't want to use grid this time. I don't need to rotate. I don't need anything like that. This is going to be canvas, and the canvas panel allows me to basically put things anywhere, right? In any position, XY coordinate, which is important because not only can I put it in a place, right? I could have done that in a grid if I had changed its margin, but a margin is a difficult thing to bind to. And it's an impossible thing to animate, right? I want to make things look as cool as they can, so I'm going to use a canvas. I want to control everything. So I'll take that away. Now, the first thing, hopefully, that you see is that everything's sort of mixed everywhere. It doesn't make too much sense. But it is kind of positioned. It's probably difficult to see because it's text on text. I want to change it so that it uses a different template. So here I'll change the template so it's no longer just the box with the text. But I don't want to take functionality away. So for now, it's just going to be like this, right? So I'll change it so if you can see that, I'll zoom in just a little bit. Remember, I have a fleet. And so I'll just make it so that I use a quick little icon and put the truck number. So this is the same as the one on the right, right? I haven't changed the data. I'm just starting to adjust the location. And so now that truck number 7 still has the same latitude and longitude as the one on the left. But instead of showing it to you just as a list of latitude and longitude, which means nothing to the user, by the way, right? It's just a bunch of messy data. Now it means something to me, right? I know exactly where that is, or at least closer to where it is than looking at the latitude and longitude raw. All I changed, by the way, was I made sure that it was on a canvas, and I changed it so that it used the truck template. If you look at that template with me, is really just, this is it right here, right? Really just a drawing of a truck and the number of the truck right over it. Nothing special at all. The XY isn't even accounted for here at all, right? This is just the way that it looks. So how do I change the XY coordinate? That's the reason I subclassed, right, the items control in the first place, or the list view in the first place. And so right here, this is just a regular list box. And this list box is subclassed. Let me take you to its definition, so you can see what it does. So look, I just inherit list box, no change at all, no change whatsoever, except for this one override. And this override doesn't change its functionality at all. All that it does is set an attached property for me. It doesn't know that it's in a canvas, right? I still have to change it to be in a canvas. But as soon as it is, it sets the top property of the canvas attached property, right? It sets its top to whatever the y, right? Whatever that y value was. And I might need in my code, because I'm just doing it as raw pixels, and if it was latitude, I might need to do some translation. So I know that if I'm going to do this, it needs to be, and then I fill in from there, right? Because I know it's 400 by 400, latitude begins in this corner, goes down to that corner, so I need to do some calculation to translate my latitude and longitude into pixels. Great, job done. Anyway, so that's what I'm doing, and the reason I'm not just setting it, which by the way I could have done, what I'm actually doing is creating a binding here so that if anything behind the scenes updates the latitude and longitude of that truck, then I want it to be updated in the UI as well, right? I can't do that if I don't bind it. And so this is the whole implementation, right? Nothing else, just setting the Y and setting the X, and that's it, right? And so this prepare container for override is called every time an item is generated and put inside the panel. And what I'm really editing is the listbox item, by the way, not the data template. This can't access the data template. And so, let me show you again. If I were to back up and see, you could see the trucks there. In fact, if I were to run it so you could see, the functionality around selecting is still there as well, right? I may not be happy with that, and I may want to come back and tweak it a little. I could be totally happy with that, by the way. That might be exactly what I want. That's totally all right, which means I could go over here and select the truck as well, right? And get the selected vehicle over here. I would want to make it so the background doesn't change, obviously. But what if, behind the scenes, there really was a real-time feed coming in, giving me the latitude and longitude of the trucks, right? My application could easily tap into that, and I want to. And so I look at the view model of this prop. The only thing missing, right, it's all implemented. If you could just look real quick, all I have is a list of items. That's a list of my trucks. And then I have the selected item, nothing else, right? This is a really simple implementation. I hope it feels simple to you, right? With the load data method, all it does is just populate a bunch of random trucks up in there. But what if in the constructor, I wanted to go ahead and create a timer, right? Let me uncomment the whole baby out. There we go. Right, so once every tenth of a second, right? It's pretty quick. Maybe yours wouldn't be this quick. Anyway, once every tenth of a second, it randomizes a number and changes its X and Y 3 to 5 points one way or another. That's all. Just to kind of show that it might be moving down a street and you want to be able to track that as well. That's all that it does, by the way. Nothing else. Just loops through all of them and randomizes them. Yours might be pulling from an actual feed, right? Streaming into you. Now remember, just like the clock, the timer inside the constructor executes in the designer as well. So you can see everybody's driving out to the ocean. It's all random. It's what's crazy. Yesterday they were all going up. Now they're all going down. It's really funny to watch. None of that matters, right? And this guy is dead. This guy and this guy is dead. They're both dead. The rest are on a suicide path. But if I were to run it, right, let's run it together. I still have all the capability around selection. See, I can still select. I can go over here and select. And I haven't changed anything at all except for the background picture, the item template, so it looks like a truck, and also the X and Y so that it moves around inside the picture. Everybody's dead. So it moves around inside the picture. Now, which is easier for a user to understand immediately, right? Which one can they actually gain value from, be able to discern from? Obviously, it's the picture. Why wouldn't we do it this way? It's just a list box with a few little changes under the hood, which really aren't that big of a deal, right? They really weren't that big of a deal. Hopefully, it didn't feel like I made gigantic customizations to these controls, because I didn't, right? And the functionality is still there inside the list box. It still interacts with me the same. It still has all the events and everything else that I want. I can add, remove. It's really great, right? And I can refresh. Give them another chance. Now they're kind of, nope, they're going down. It's fascinating. I seed it based on time. I wonder if it has to do with time. No, it's random, right? That's the whole idea. All right. Is it cool? That's pretty nice, I think. All right. So here are the things I can change inside of the items control, right? So first the panel. So we change that to canvas. Then we change the way that it looks. But look at this. What if I wanted to do one more thing? What if I go in and I say, look at this neat little gizmo here. What if I said they aren't all trucks? Sometimes I've got a few cars in there, and I want to show them as well. But I have the item template based on a truck, right? How do I switch that out? The right way to switch it out is with a data template selector. So by default, the item template sets it to whatever is in there, right? Just one. But if I use a data template selector, I create the logic. So look, here's my map selector, and it inherits from data template selector. And all I need to do is overwrite select template core. As soon as I do that, I just put my own logic right here. If the item coming in is a truck, right, then return the truck template. Otherwise, return the car template. That's as simple as the selector needs to be, and that's all that it does, right? Nothing else. So I just test my item, which has a property called truck. If a truck is true, then use truck or car. I could add so much logic to this, it's crazy, based on time, based on location, if the user's an admin, anything that I want to put here, right? It's all up to me. So now if I go into my definition down here, I'm going to take the item template, and I'm not going to use it anymore. And instead, I'm going to uncomment, right? My item template selector. So here's my items control. It has a property called item template selector, and I'm going to use my map selector. And remember, it had two properties. The first one was the car template. The second one was the truck template. And so I can set those explicitly right here inside XAML. So it has the car template and the truck template set to a resource that I have defined, right? Just like before, it's just the path of a car. One's the path of a truck. As simple as that, right? And so now you can see I've already got changes. The red are the cars. The blue are the trucks. If I were to run this one, you can see it's all set up for me. And it's swapping between the different templates based on the data that comes in. You use whatever logic you want. Somebody has car trouble, it switches to red, right? Whatever it is you need to do, it all shows up here for you, right? This is 3,000 times more valuable than this very nice list box on the left. Right, there's no getting around it. 3,000 times, I did the math. All right, so the third one down is the item template selector, and then the fourth one down is when I subclassed that so that I could prepare container for item override. Remember, that's where I set the X and Y to the canvas top and left. All right, now for a custom behavior. This is extremely useful. We talked about behaviors before. I'm going to attempt to implement this go right up to the edge here. So this is going to be demo 6. It's going to be tight. All right, let me create a couple of folders here. In the common folder, because we're going to make this mostly MVVM, I'll use a bindable base here. And it's going to be down to the wire here. A delegate command. Delegate command allows a view to talk to a view model. I've got a snippet for that as well. Nothing you need to see here. This is a standard implementation. I'll give you the code, so don't worry about that. And then inside, I'll just create a quick view model for the main page. This is the main page view model. Again, I'm just going to show off how to create a behavior. So I'll create two quick properties. I'll create a text property, and then I'll also create a result property. And then we need a delegate. A delegate command. And we'll just call this update command. Inside there, we're going to return the delegate command. You might actually do a test to make sure you don't create this more than once. But for the sake of this demo, we'll do it like this. The delegate command constructor requires a delegate. And in this case, I'll use an anonymous method. And all I'm going to do is set the result to the text. I'll just say thank you. And then say what the text was. There we go. Just that text. All right, that's all the implementation for the view model. And all I want there is for the command to be able to execute and set the result. All right, so now I'm going to create my first behavior in the behaviors folder. This is going to be, there's a functional thing you might want that when you're inside a text box, you want to hit enter and have something happen. So I'll add the behaviors SDK. That is installed with Visual Studio, so you all have it. You just have to make a reference to it. Behavior needs to inherit from dependency object, and then it also needs to implement iBehavior, which is part of that SDK you just added, right? It has a simple property of associated project, and then in the attach, you just set the associated object to the property that's passed in. Now that it's passed in, I know that it's a text box. It's going to have a key down event, and in the key down event, I'm going to have a handler. And the reason I'll set a handler here is because I want to go and unwire that when it's detached, right? This is so I don't keep hold of it and make it so garbage collection doesn't work. A dependency property will allow me now to bind outside. It will not be a hidden dependency property. It's a collection of all the actions. Actions are children of behaviors. They're the things that you want to actually occur. So a dependency property has a default, but I don't care about that default. And so this is the actions collection. It's important to me that the action collection not be null. So if it is null, I'm going to go ahead and set it to be new. Actually, I'll set this version and my local variable here to be new and just return it. All right. So now I have my actions property. The last thing I really need is to make sure that the user doesn't attach this behavior to just anything. They have to only attach it to, there's the type constraint of a text box. That makes sure that this behavior is only for a text box. One other thing is I'll make sure that the content property, when Blend is looking at this, it knows that it's my actions property. All right. The actions property is then, it's a collection, so I can have as many actions as I want to. Let's implement then the behavior. If the key down is enter, right, then I'll loop through all of the actions in my actions collection. Might be empty, by the way. I hope it's not. Action.execute, I'll pass in the associated object and no parameter at all. All right, that's the full implementation of the behavior. It's really simplistic on purpose. I'm going to now create an attached behavior, or an attached property. An attached property works the same way. It's the second way to extend a control. So the same logic, I'm going to basically do the same thing. In this case, I'm going to ask for the command that that the user wants to execute whenever the user presses enter in the text box. So the same solution, two different solutions for the same problem. Let me add this using. I'm going to make it. All right, so whenever the command changes, so they're setting it to, remember I created that update command in my view model. If it's passing in a new value, and that new value is a command, right, then I want to go ahead and fetch the text box, which is basically that D for the dependency object is being passed in. It's possible that they've attached it to something that's not a text box. I don't have that same constraint as I do for a behavior, so I'll just raise an exception right here. Then I'll get the command. So the command is what they just passed in, that new value. And the logic here is going to be the delegate that I do for the key down. This is going to be exactly the same as the logic I did in the behavior. Again, two solutions for the same problem. In this case, I just execute the command. And I'm running a little tight here, so I'm going to go quick. You can have all this logic. And so a quick, let me give you a quick UI here. I'll put in two text boxes. We'll start with the first text box. This will be for the behavior. And I'll bind its text property to text. Because it's a text box, I'll make its mode two-way. And I'll make sure that its source trigger is property changed so it updates as I type. The attach behavior will be the second one. I'm going to need to reference my view model under data context, right? So I'll just add a quick reference to my view model. There it is on line 11. And now I can, let's just lay it, it's a little narrow, I'll make it a little bit bigger, and add a button here at the bottom that will bind directly to the command. So I click the button, and it works fine. It goes straight to my delegate command inside my view model. But what I don't have yet is a way of interacting from the text box. Remember, I want the user to be able to hit enter. And so I put everything inside the same namespace, just for convenience. Behaviors on inner property. Remember, that's the property I created. And we'll bind it to the command itself. Now, It's easiest to do a behavior in Blend. My behaviors are all going to be hidden up in my Assets tab. So if I go to Behaviors, there's my on inner behavior. I'll just drag that over then onto my text box. As soon as I do, you can see it down there at the bottom. I can also drag then the action that I want, which is invoke command. So I'll bind it to my update command. So now I have my binding, or now I have my behavior set up, and I also have my property set up. You can see the logic right there. And just so I can see what that result is, I'll put the result a little bit bigger so that we can see every time we run the command. Right? So if I go in and I hit the button, thank you, test. If I type in behavior, hit enter. There you can test, test. If I go to the attached property, hit enter. Thank you, test, test, test. Right? Beautiful. All three work. So all three are ways that I can invoke a command. Two of them are the ways that I can let the user do it directly from my customization. Remember, I could have subclassed that text box to add functionality as well. So there's two awesome ways to do it. And so the first one is subclassing an attached property or a custom behavior. Hopefully you saw how simple the custom behavior was. They were rewritten and re-implemented inside Windows XAML, and it's different than the way they're done in WPF. WPF, they were a little convoluted. They're super simplified inside Windows XAML. What I didn't get to show you was the list view persistence helper. Unbelievable way of suspending your application, resuming, and then scrolling back into a list to the same position you were before. A lot of us do this the hard way, and now there's a helper built into the framework for it. Customizing the layout panel, allowing you to lay things out the way you want, that's another topic by itself, would take an entire hour to show, but it's awesome. And the idea of data versus visual virtualization, so that as the user scrolls, they have an awesome experience, and you don't consume all the memory in their app, in their PC. And then using an iValue converter to debug is pretty fantastic. And the idea of this value, the proxy class to hold values so that you can animate your entire UI or property for properties that usually can't be animated. All right, so this is what we talked about. Since I'm short on time, I will see you tomorrow. I have the introductory to Prism for Windows Runtime. If you're interested in that, that's the full MVVM implementation through the Patterns and Practices framework of Prism, super lightweight framework. See you then. If you have any questions, please stay around afterwards. I'm happy to talk to all of you or answer any questions. Since I'm out of time, though, I can't take any questions just here, but we'll see you all again. Keep XAMLing. Don't forget to evaluate.